Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for the Fight Night Picks podcast with your host, Craig Allen.
It's Friday, June 8th. Fight Night Picks podcast episode number 17. Another banger of a sode. Let's get into it. Episode number 17, Friday edition. So, I've got an interview today with Zane Simon. We're going to go over the UFC 225 card from tomorrow night. Also got an interview with Gerald Hurricane Harris, former UFC World Series of Fighting, Dream, Legacy, and now he's with Bellator, and he's got a fight coming up in July. So, interviews with them. First of all, I'd like to thank First Row Collectibles for sponsoring the show. Head on over to firstrow.ca, use the promo code FNP at checkout. You'll save shipping on your order today. We're also brought to you by Sisu Mouthguard. I've had one for a number of years. Definitely the best boil and bite mouthguard I've had. Visit them at Sisu, S-I-S-U, guard.com and use the promo code FNP10 to save 10% on your order today. All right, so we might as well just get right into my interview with Gerald Harris. So, here's Gerald. How's it going?
Hey, what's up?
Not a whole lot going on in Fredericton, New Brunswick on a Friday.
Give me a sec, I'm carrying a whole bunch of shit tomorrow, man.
Sounds good, man.
I'm ready to see one man on this weight.
Oh, did he?
Yep, 5 pounds.
Shit. I saw he was trying to wait it out and make 185, but man. Mm-hmm. So it'd be a non-title fight, wouldn't it?
No, he got 2 hours.
Oh, he's got two, okay. Yeah, that's always the trouble when I do, like, usually I'll do my UFC on, like, a Friday, and then I try and do it while weigh-ins are going on. So I've got my finger on the pulse, but I did one yesterday, so yeah, that sucks.
You get 2 hours from the time you weigh in.
Okay.
So that's why he waited till the last minute.
Yeah, oh, that makes sense then. He should be fine.
Yeah, he can lose a pound. It's going to be hard, though.
Yeah. So, you've got a fight coming up. Your second one in Bellator, it's in your home state on the 13th. You're fighting a young guy, Jesus, almost my age, 19-0, Yaroslav Amosov. You're going to be welterweight for that, eh?
Oh my gosh, this would be my last fight at welterweight.
I saw it was welterweight, and I was surprised.
I don't think they knew my intentions when I came to Bellator. My full intention was to go middleweight.
Yeah.
Too hard of a cut. I like the Robert Whittaker route where he just, you know, went up and felt good. And look at him. He was undefeated.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what I thought. And at the same time, is there any chance they move that card or that fight onto the main card?
No, you know what? I think it's because of late addition. I think that card was already set and they just kind of added me to it. So,
yeah.
I raised a little fuss online just for fun. You never know if something happens. I want to put my name in the hat. If they ever had a, you know, a spot, but so far I'm glad they put me on the card. So, you know, it's better than sitting at home.
Yeah, and it's awesome that you get to fight in your home state too. And I mean, you've competed for World Series of Fighting, Legacy, UFC, Dream, and now Bellator. What was it like getting the call to take on Lovato Jr. on short notice?
Well, you know, I've never turned down a fight, but this one, I was like, nah, man, 3 days of weigh in. That was my biggest problem. I'll fight somebody on 24, I noticed. It was the fact that I was heavy. I was about 215. I had to cut all the way down to 188. I said 190, but they negotiated an extra 2 pounds, which was annoying. But, you know, the ball wasn't in my court at that time. But, yeah, man, it was exactly what I needed. I was tired of fighting locally. I had torn my Achilles the day before going to Ultimate Fighter Season 25. And it just, man, it was just kind of almost like a deal breaker. I was done after that injury. Nobody really wanted to deal with me. And Bellator's got so much talent, they didn't really,
was the plan to get back into fighting or stay retired? Like, I know you mentioned you wanted to get on the Ultimate Fighter.
I had zero intentions on fighting again.
Yeah.
I had my last fight. It was a title fight. And it was a slam finish. I mean, it couldn't get no better. So I was like, I'm done. And then I just got the phone call. I had no intentions on fighting.
Yeah. How many slam finishes do you have in your career so far?
I think four. I had one over Jorge Santiago, but the referee probably did one of the dumbest things I've ever seen in my life. I slammed Jorge down and would have finished him. The referee jumps in and takes away a point. I'm like, let me finish him. That was stupid.
Yeah.
For fence grabbing. He stopped action to give a point for fence grabbing.
Yeah, I mean, the one that sticks out in my mind is obviously the one at UFC 116 with David Branch. And, I mean, he was grabbing the fence at one point in that fight, too, and they didn't take a point on him. But you had two slams in that fight, and then finally the second one, you got the knockout. And you didn't punch him after that, which was nice to see, too.
Yeah. He kept grabbing the cage, too. You know, it was a little frustrating.
I've been, yeah.
But no, man, the first knockout I got, I slammed the guy, broke his ribs. Then it was David Branch, and then it was the legacy fight where the guy was overweight and I powerbombed him.
Yeah.
Like, face planting. And then the last one was I picked the guy up, threw him down, and he planted his hand and dislocated his elbow.
Jeez, that's tough. So, plan was to be on season 25 of The Ultimate Fighter, but you did get to go on season 7. What was that like?
Man, I can honestly say it was too early in my career. I had only been training for a year when I got on Ultimate Fighter.
Jeez.
No boxing, no sparring. Worked out at Team Quest for like a month. But I was such a raw talent, you know?
Yeah.
They went ahead and took me. And I was on a 2-fight losing streak. I had lost two. My first two losses were Fabio Leopoldo and what's the guy's name? Really tough guy. So, I mean, I wasn't in a position to be on Ultimate Fighter, and boom, it happened, man. It was crazy, but you know what? That show, as soon as that show ended, I took fighting more serious. I started training full-time. I quit my job. I trained with CB Dalloway and Ryan Bader for like a year. Then I moved back to Tulsa, started training with a really good boxing gym, get my hands right. And I started knocking everybody out, man. I also trained with Rampage, like three of his camps. The Ultimate Fighter was more. It was better for me after the show.
Yeah, I mean, I had a look at your record there, and after the Ultimate Fighter, I mean, you went on a tear. Then you got into the UFC, obviously 3-1, three knockouts, right?
Like 10 wins in a row.
Yeah.
And what pissed me off is that was the first year we had a fight to get in the house, and then also that was the first year where everybody got cut after the show.
Yeah.
Normally you get one fight. So you get in, you're in. Dude, they cut us.
Yeah.
They called me like, yeah, we're going to let you go. I'm like, damn. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
That one was a heartbreaker.
But back into fighting, back with Bellator, you've got what, like 3 fights after this on your contract, I think?
4.
There you go. And you get to fight in your home state, back to welterweight. So you're hoping to move back up to middleweight, I would assume?
I will.
Yeah.
I'm too old for 170, man. I'll be 39 this year. I can't be setting no damn 170.
Makes sense. Still got the comedy going on, too?
In high
school. Yeah. So, are you still teaching? Still keeping up with the comedy?
Comedy's going great. Sold out shows. I had to stop teaching. It was taking up too much of my time.
Yeah.
So, I started a gym. My wife and I own the gym. That's a lot less stress than teaching badass kids all day.
Yeah, it makes sense. Both my parents are teachers.
Man, it's a very it's probably, other than the military, it's probably one of the most underappreciated jobs in America.
For sure. What's the comedy scene like down in Oklahoma?
It's cool. I kind of run it in my town, you know? Me and my good friends, we put on shows together. But it's you know what? It's one of those places where you got to move if you want to make it.
Yeah. Do you do any college shows in like Stillwater? I mean, I was down there. No?
I haven't gotten into college scene, man. That's the crazy thing. It's good money. You got to have a bigger name. And if I get this Comedy Central deal, I'll probably get booked on those things. But I'm a promoter and a performer, so I kind of book my own shows.
Yeah, that's good to hear. No, I was down there last year for a week. I went down to Perry, and then we did the tour of Stillwater, too. Nice place yeah. down there.
That's cool, man. Old Perry, Oklahoma. You went to two of the least exciting towns. Stillwater has pretty... Now, Stillwater's cool, man, but Perry's pretty small.
Yeah, I sold Ditch Witch equipment up here in Canada, so... Well, I mean, that's about all I've got for you. I won't take up too much more of your time. Hopefully, the Bellator, you know, event that's taking place coming up here in July goes well for you. Home state fight. And, yeah, keep going.
Man, I really appreciate you having me. Sorry, I got so much going on. Got kids running around. I'm trying to eat. I mean, it's all over the place. But you know what? I see big things happening. This kid's going to be tough. He's undefeated. You know, and I don't know what they expect from me. I don't know if they're, I know they're going to be prepared, but I don't know if they're assuming, you know, I'm, you know, for my last fight that I'm not ready, but hey, I'm really excited to be a part of Bellator. I'm definitely going to finish my career. And, man, that's it.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gerald.
All right, thanks for having me.
All right, it was awesome to have Gerald Harris on the podcast. I mean, most of you know him from The Ultimate Fighter Season 7. It kind of came out at one point. I heard on the James Lynch Parting Shot podcast that he had a chance to be on season 25 of The Ultimate Fighter, but had to pull out due to injury. And now he's in Bellator full time, and he's got a fight coming up this July. So really want to thank Gerald for coming on the podcast. It was awesome to have him on. And why don't we just keep rolling? So last night we had PFL number one from MSG. It was the very first event. It was it's kind of the reinvention of World Series of Fighting on NBC. I think they've had one PFL event already. I know Jay Glazer hosted it, and they had Blagoy Ivanov, who you're going to see take on JDS later on this summer. They've got an announcing team of Randy Couture, Boss Rutten, they've got Todd Harris, and then on the desk they've got Caroline Pierce and Eve Edward, who was just with Fox covering the UFC. Their whole premise is that the last event of this PFL season is going to be held on New Year's Eve. They're going to have 6 championship fights and $10 million grand prize dispersed between the champs. So a lot of money there. And it's kind of a tournament-style format. So you've got right now, it was called PFL number one regular season. So basically every fighter gets, I believe, 2 regular season matchups. They utilize a point scoring system to slot playoff spots. So it's kind of similar to a baseball or an NHL. Maximum amount of points you can get in a fight is 6, so if you had a first round knockout, that'd be 6 points, and then the minimum amount is like 3 for a decision. So some of the fights of note from last night on the prelims, you had former UFC fighter Francimar Barroso making his debut. He had just fought John Volante in January, split decision loss there, moving up to heavyweight, taking on James Gallimore, who fought in World Series of Fighting. There's a lot of fighters on these cards that were involved with World Series of Fighting at some point or another, but a lot that came from the UFC and from Bellator as well. So Francimar Barroso ended up with a first round finish over Gallimore. I had tweeted out during the fight with about 2 minutes left that I figured it was going to end by doctor stoppage between the first and second rounds, but Dan Murgliato was reffing the bout, and he put a stop to it. Gallimore's eye was one of his eyes was completely swollen shut. One of the neat things, again, that I'd like to mention from PFL, apart from just their format, is that there's no elbows allowed. And I know in M1, I kind of talked about it last week, but no elbows allowed. I think it's kind of more of an arbitrary rule for them, but for PFL, their reasoning is that elbows are sharp and you could get cut. And in this tournament-style format, fighters could have, you know, 4 or 5 fights in the span of 6 months, and then it usually, with an athletic commission, if you have any cut whatsoever on your face, I mean, we even saw it with Jessica Aguilar, where in New York, her lips were chapped, and the commission wouldn't let her fight. So they don't want fighters to have to sacrifice fights and miss fights due to cuts. So no elbows in PFL. Another fight on the undercard, you had Steven Seiler with the second biggest underdog win at plus 1100. He's taking on Magomed Idrisov, and I had assumed that Idrisov was going to be able to get an easy win. I mean, he was cruising through that first round, and Seiler got him in kind of an armbar and then transitioned it into a triangle choke. So He got a huge underdog win. I saw on Twitter that Justin Hartling from Oddshark had said that it was the second biggest underdog win in professional MMA behind Sokoju with plus 1350 win at Pride 33. So kind of a neat fight there. Also on your undercard, you had former UFC vet Jared Rossholt taking on Valdrin Estreffi. He got the unanimous decision win there. Rossholt did. And so the first four fights that they had on the card, which were live on Facebook, all the prelims were live on Facebook, but the first four ended in first-round finishes. So they had some filler material there. They kind of jumbled around some of the matchups. I believe Rossholt, that fight was supposed to be on the main card, and jumbled fights around, and they ended up with a post-lim fight between two former UFC heavyweights, Jack May and the cuddly bear, Josh Copeland. And if you watch the fight, Copeland was super aggressive at the start. May threw an early knee to the body. It kind of hurt Copeland. And then with 33 seconds left in the round, he threw another kick to the body that hurt Copeland. And May ended up with a TKO win. On your main card, there were two bigger fights. Your co-main, you had 12-3 Lance Palmer. I've talked about him in the past few weeks. He had a fight with Georgie Karakanyan at one point. He was taking on 19-1 Bekbalat Magomedov. And I had said take Magomedov. I mean, if you really look through his record, he had a number of knockouts, a few submissions, quite a few decision wins. But Lance Palmer was able to get the second round rear naked choke win. And then in your main event, you had the New Yorker Andre Harrison, teammates with Gregor Gillespie. He was taking on Jambaki Tershin. Tershin formerly fought in the UFC, and Harrison ended up with a unanimous decision win. But with that whole playoff format, I mean, Harrison got 3 points out of that win, and someone else in the featherweight division could have got six. So it's kind of difficult. I mean, it all ends up with the way that the playoffs are seeded. And a neat idea from PFL and from NBC. And I had heard a report somewhere on Twitter where they're handing out $10 million in prize money to the fighters. They could incur a loss. NBC could incur a loss of between $10 and $15 million with this first season. So it'll be interesting to see what they end up doing. I guess second season would hinge upon online ratings and whether the broadcasts get picked up even more online. I know the sponsorships are there. A lot of people commented that they like the clean look of the trunks, but at the same time, fighters are allowed to have some sponsors on there as well, so they can make a little bit more money. But neat event to start off from PFL and NBC. And at the same time, you've got Bare Knuckle FC getting their first event on the ground and getting going last weekend. So it'll be interesting to see what PFL has next, as well as Bare Knuckle FC. So on Saturday morning, coming at you live at 10 o'clock Atlantic, 9 o'clock Eastern from Belfast, Northern Ireland, you've got Brave CF 13. It's their first event in Europe. It's a really interesting event. You know, your main event is a rematch of Brave CF 1. You got a bantamweight title fight between 10-2 Stephen Lohman. He's taking on 5-2 Franz Malambo. It's tough. I mean, you look at the record and you think, well, you know, Malambo probably doesn't have too much experience. But if you look through his amateur record, he's had a lot of fights. He trains out of SBG. Lohman's on a 4-fight win streak. He won the vacant title last November by first round knockout. But yeah, I mean, Malambo, I think, is going to get the win. Like I said, since he lost to Lohman, that was in the fall of 2016, he's finished 3 straight fights. And then your co-main event, you've got a former UFC vet in 24-6-1, Norman Park. He's taken on 10-6, Miles Price. Park has a win over Price from 2010. He submitted him. And Price also has a loss on his record from 2015 against ACB's Kane Musa. Pick Park to get the win. I mean, half of his wins are by submission. And don't be surprised if we see that again. And Miles Price actually just fought at Bama 35, which was, geez, 3 or 4 weeks ago. So take Norman Park in that. You got another card on Saturday morning. It's just about the same time as Brave. So KSW 44, The Game, coming at you at 11 o'clock Atlantic, 10 o'clock Eastern. I don't know if anybody saw their promo. It was on YouTube. I know they're, like, I'm looking at their poster right now. It's two guys in the sea, one with a trident, Carl Badorf. And they had a pretty good intro. It was almost like Street Fighter. But your main event, you've got Carol Bador, 14-3, taking on Marius Pudzianowski. He's 12-5. I'm going to go and tell you, take Pudzianowski in that fight. You know, Bador coming off a loss to Fernando Rodriguez Jr. In December of 2016. Pudzianowski's been more active, and he's on a 3-fight win streak. I mean, I know if you look on Tapology right now, I think Bador's rated the 60th best heavyweight in the world, whereas Pudzianowski's 117, but that doesn't mean a whole lot. Take Pudzianowski to get the win there. Also on your main card, you've got Tomasz Oświęcimski. And he's taking on a professional bodybuilder in Erko June. June's making his professional debut. Osvachensky's got one win. It's kind of cut and dry. I mean, both guys making 265. I watched June train. He was kind of throwing a bag around in the gym and also hitting pads. Osvachensky's quite a bit older, but at the same time, he has experience. Take the experience, Osvachensky, to get the win. Also on this card, you've got Wagner Prado. He's 13-3, fought in the UFC at one point, taking on Chris Fields, 12-7-1. Take Prado in that fight. This should be a good card. If you've never watched a KSW card, they put on a good show, and I'm going to be watching it on the Fight TV app. You can buy it on there. All right, this episode of the podcast is brought to you by First Row Collectibles. We had First Row's Curtis Housen on a number of weeks ago now. And if you head on over to their website, I mean, the NHL playoffs ended last night. You had the Washington Capitals sweeping the Vegas Golden Knights. But, I mean, head on over there. Lots of hockey cards. They've got autographed Jonathan Marchessault rookie card. A lot of good baseball rookie cards. Some old episodes of some old Sports Illustrated magazines. A lot of wrestling autographs as well. And some MMA autographs on there too. So head on over to First Row. Use the promo code FNP at checkout. You'll save yourself the shipping. Free shipping on your order. And to our American listeners, keep in mind all the prices on First Row are in Canadian dollars. It says it right there. And you're going to be saving roughly 25% on your order if you go with First Row. So visit them at firstrow.ca, promo code FNP. Geez, there's even a Johnny Manziel card on there. We're also brought to you by Sisu Mouth Guards. I've had one for a number of years now. One game I didn't wear the mouth guard in, I broke my front tooth. And it probably cost me about $1,000, whether it was racing around from dentist's office to a dental lab or actually spending money on the tooth. So if you head on over to sisuguard.com, enter the promo code FNP10, you'll save 10% on your order today. It's definitely a great mouth guard. It's a boil and bite. It's way thinner than any other boil and bite you've ever used. If you're into MMA, you could definitely wear it in an interview after the fight. You could talk to your corner people, drink water. It's easy to talk and it's easy to drink water. I wear it in hockey. It's great. You can yell to your line mate across the ice for a pass, what have you. So head on over to sisuguard.com, promo code FNP10. All right, so moment you've all been waiting for. You got UFC 225 coming up on Saturday night. I had a conversation yesterday with Zane Simon from Bloody Elbow MMA Vivisection Podcast, and we went over the whole card and made our picks for it. So here's the conversation I had with Zane. Big news today. Might as well talk about it. I don't know if it's big news in California, but it's the biggest news in New Brunswick. We got a fight card coming up in Moncton.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Man, like, it's an hour and a half away from home. Brand new arena just opened up. The arena they had before was, like, ancient. Like, really old. So, I was on a job site there. I used to sell heavy equipment and sold it for a year and a half. And we had to do a drill job and pull a storm drain through because they built the arena and forgot to put the storm drain in. So we were there, and yeah, it's like 8,800 seats, plus you can have 1,500 on the floor if they have a concert. I mean, obviously that's going to change with a ring in the middle, but I mean, it's a bigger arena than you'd have in some European spots, and I mean, in Chile, I think they had under 9,000 there, so should be good.
Well, if it's anything like the upcoming Utica event, they'll fill half of it, so.
That? How many
hopefully
did they
you get more fever for it up there.
How many did they draw at Utica? Did it come out?
I don't think so, but most reports from people who were at the event said that the arena was, like, half full and that people were leaving before the main event.
Yeah, like, it looked like a small arena for sure, and then it didn't look like they filled it. Like, I would have thought you got a hometown or kind of a hometown guy with Gregor Gillespie, and then, yeah, just didn't
see. Attendance was 5,063.
Fuck. Yeah, that's bad. Yeah. But I mean, when they had the card in Halifax last year when I went, it was completely full. And again this year, I mean, the good thing about Moncton is, obviously you're definitely not going to be aware of where it is, but it's about 150,000 people that live there, a province of just under 800,000 people, and then you've got Nova Scotia, and you've got Prince Edward Island, and then you've got Maine next to us. You're going to draw from all of that. It's called the Hub City for that reason. So it should draw well. Brand new arena. And I see today that Chad Laprise said he'd be there. So hopefully he's coming back off a dirty knockout loss to Vicente Luque.
Yeah, I hope it works out as a good venue. The UFC definitely looks like they're trying to spread out to some of the smaller, more like remote potential places they've missed. You know, this whole new or last run they went on to, where like going to Utica, going to Santiago, Chile, places like that. Not that Santiago is necessarily small, but places that you wouldn't expect a UFC event to be. So.
Yeah, I mean, most people figured, like, this morning there was a little GIF that came out and it said, where do you want, or where do you think the UFC is going to stop in Canada? And they didn't even feature, like, New Brunswick on the map. They didn't even, like, gloss over it. So everybody figured it was going to be Toronto or Montreal. And, yeah, pretty surprising that they're coming to Moncton, New Brunswick. But, yeah, like, who knows what they're going to do? There's some local talent here. I mean, there's Christian Savoy, 6-0, I think, right now, is middleweight. There was talk he might be on the card in July in Calgary. And there's a lot of other talent. I mean, you got Gavin Tucker, too, so should be a good card.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I'm always interested when the UFC is trying to break into a new place like that, see what they can put together. I don't know how many fighters they'll necessarily. There's always a lot of talk like, oh, these are the guys the UFC's got to sign when they go to XYZ place, and it doesn't really seem like they really work like that anymore. So I don't necessarily know that I'd bet on anybody too local being on it, but it'll probably be filled with Canadian fighters they already have.
Yeah, for sure. If you could grade the last three UFC cards, you know, Utica, Chile, like what would you give them? And Liverpool.
Yeah, well, you could even go back to UFC 224 too. I mean, that's kind of it's like C minus, you know? Like, they're all events that had their particular highs and lows. There are great moments from each card. Rivera Moraes, you know, the head kick KO was certainly cool and all that. That funky Jared Brooks knocking himself out slam and going back to the Thompson Till card, you had like Claudio Silva getting that come from behind submission and Arnold Allen getting that submission in the third round. Like, there's cool stuff on all of them, but nobody's gonna remember any of these cards after UFC 225. Even before then, they may not remember them. And when you're making that little impact, then it's really hard to then be like, oh yeah, this was anything better than your basic average run-of-the-mill fight card.
But finally, we've got a pretty good card coming up this weekend. Probably, you know, best one in recent memory, like you said. And to your point, I mean, Chile, I put up a poll on Twitter and the consensus was it was a B card. And now that I look back at Chile, Utica, Liverpool, I'd agree with you. I'd say like C minus. I mean,
Yeah.
you stack the main event, but then after that, it's not great. I mean, when you're going back and you're trying to break down those cards, it's pretty hard to go. I mean, there's a lot of unranked fighters on there too, and not a lot
Well,
of hate behind them.
you got to consider, A plus, you're talking, you're like Bisping GSP, you're Conor McGregor, big cards that are getting everybody really excited. So, I mean, UFC Liverpool, Thompson Till, there were people for the Utica card who were like, there's UFC this weekend, like on the day, you know?
Yeah. And I saw a lot of people too, MMA journalists alike, that were they were just recording it and watching it the next day. So
Yeah, it's.
I find it's hard to do that because I'm always on Twitter and then I see the results. Just like
Yeah.
when they had Bellator 200, it was kind of tough for me. And I actually did. I saw the result to like maybe two of the fights, so it was still new for me when I watched it on tape delay. But 225 on Saturday night. Do you think the way that they've got, we talked about this, but obviously audio didn't come through. Do you think that with the new ESPN deal, this is the type of card we're going to see in the future?
With this UFC 225,
Yeah.
oh yeah, I don't think that the ESPN. If anything, we're probably going to see more pay-per-views that look like this, and more cards before them that look like Thompson Till, Maya Uthman, Rivera Moraes, where you've got like a fight and then a whole bunch of stuff where you're just like, I don't know, whatever, maybe. A bunch of dudes that we need to give contract fights to. I would say it's probably going to slant even more that way because it seems like the ESPN Plus deal, especially the ESPN Plus part of it, not so much the TV card, which the TV cards, which are going to still, much like the Fox Sports cards, the Fox Sports cards are still, the UFC still needs to draw ratings for those. They still need to show a discernible value for that. But for the ESPN Plus cards, it kind of seems like the ESPN's taking that as a loss leader. They're paying up front, saying, okay, here's $10 million an event, and you'll put on these, 15 events on our streaming service, and if they're not drawing a ton of streaming traffic over that, I don't think that that's really going to matter. ESPN, the goal of the platform is to show diversity, to get a bunch of name sports that people recognize, and to have a variety. So the UFC is just providing that variety up front, and they can just fill those with, what we've been seeing out of Fight Pass and what we've started to see as Fox Sports 1 cards now, where it's just like, guys fighting. And that leaves the pay-per-views more concentrated. You push all of your fights that people actually care about, all the big fights, they're just going to be on pay-per-view at this point.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like, on this one, your Fight Pass prelims, Dan Ige and Mike Santiago. Like, I mean, to me, it's a good fight. That's one of those ones. It's a good one to start off the card. Ige had a good fight against Julio Arce. You saw Arce this past weekend fight well. I think it's going to be an Ige win. Then you've got Clay Guida, who's kind of found a bit of a resurgence in his last two fights. He was supposed to fight Bobby Green. Now he's fighting Charles Oliveira. I honestly, like, going through my picks, and I'll fill in the cracks when I give my total preview on the podcast. But I think that one's a tough one to pick, where Oliveira is so good on the ground, and Guida, he beat Eric Koch, he beat Joe Lauzon, but Lauzon's kind of at the end of the line, I guess, so to speak, with UFC. So I'm gonna pick the betting favorite in that one, and Oliveira.
Yeah, I mean, I still have to watch more tape for Santiago Ige before I would probably, part of me wants to go with Ige, but his style is so slow paced. Like, he's a grinding wrestler, and he throws a couple of big power shots to get to that. And Santiago is much more of a, like, hard nose, high output, scrambling fighter. I'm not as confident on that one. But I would have to go Oliveira over Guida just because Guida, knocking out Joe Lauzon is not the masterful thing. It's not the mark of accomplishment that it used to be. And otherwise, Guida's always had a hole in his submission defense. Like, he's been submitted by Thiago Tavares, he's been submitted by Dennis Bermudez, he's been submitted by Kenny Florian and Roger Huerta. So it's not even always like great submission fighters who've submitted him over the years. It's just a hole he has in his game. And Oliveira's tough enough standing that he's probably going to keep this competitive on the feet or even maybe win it there. Guida's boxing has actually improved. But Oliveira's grappling, you have to fight really hard through his first round or round and a half of grappling offense, and I don't know that Guida necessarily has the defense to do that.
Yeah, like, I mean, for me, the kind of deciding fact, I mean, Oliveira, really, if you look into it, I mean, he's a guy that sticks in most people's minds, but he's 2-4 in his last six. Losses to Holloway, Anthony Pettis, Ricardo Lamas, Paul Felder. I mean, really good names in that division. And 20 of his 22 wins coming by finish and 14 by submission. And I mean, yeah, that's going to cause problems for Guida. And like you said, a hole in his game, the submission defense. That loss to Kenny Florian was quite a while ago. So really hasn't shored it up. And going back to the Ige and Santiago fight, I think kind of the reason why I picked Ige to win, and why I think it's going to be a pretty easy one. You know, Santiago had six finishes in a row, and then he lost to Mads Burnell, and he lost to Zabit, too. And, I mean, yeah. Zabit, obviously top competition, but Mads Burnell, I mean, you saw him in his fight against Arnold Allen. He gave him fits, and he's a bigger guy. But, yeah, I mean, it's kind of, it reminds me of an Ige-type fighter, but Ige's got the better better stand-up. So that's kind of why I would take Dan Ige in that one.
I'm not sure about the stand-up there. I mean...
Yeah?
Yeah, Mads Brunel's really impressed me with his boxing and what he's... Like, you know, we saw in the Arnold Allen fight, he's slipping and ducking, coming back with counters and things like that. Ige, he's got a big... He'll throw, like, a big power shot, but, like, Julio Arce styled on him in that fight. Yeah. It was, you know, it was, like, tripling up on Ige in punch output. And if your output's going to be that low, then he's going to have to win this fight entirely by control. Mads Burnell was able to do that to Santiago, but Mads Burnell also came in, like, several pounds heavy off a bad weight cut and looked like he really made use of that size, so... I mean, I'd give Ige the edge, but Santiago has classically, he's a good battle-tested fighter who tends to scramble a lot and make fights messy, so.
Yeah, like you said, 21-11, so he's definitely, he's been in some fights. Next fight, you got number one against number five, which, again, it's kind of strange to see on the early fight pass prelims, but Slim Shady and Sergio Pettis. I mean, I get Shady to win. Two losses to Demetrius Johnson, two to Dominic Cruz, and that new hairstyle, I think it's going to win it for him.
Is that what he's going by now? Slim Shady?
No, but that's just what I'm calling him. You didn't see a picture of him?
Oh, with the blonde hair now?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I get it.
Like, Joseph Benavidez, I mean, he's number one for a reason, 25-4 overall. Sergio Pettis, 16-3. I mean, up-and-comer at one point, but... yeah, I think Benavidez outclasses him wherever the fight goes.
I admit I'm a little tentative on Benavidez coming off a bad knee injury. You know, he blew out his, what was it, it's like ACL, MCL.
Yeah.
And so that always gives me a little pause, especially for a fighter as based on speed as he is. And I do like the changes in game, tightening up, becoming a more consistent control striker at range, not trying, you know, being less trying to be less of what his brother is and this, like, exciting power striker and more of a mind your P's and Q's, tight defensively, range kickboxer who just wins rounds and can slowly take over fights. But, yeah, he'd have to show... He'd either have to be able to beat Benavidez on the mat and hold him down, or he'd have to show that he's really put something extra in his strikes, because Benavidez is just going to have a big power advantage and the speed advantage, and that means a lot at flyweight.
Yeah, and it should be a really great flyweight matchup, for sure. I mean, we get number one and number five, but yeah, I got Benavidez in that one. Last fight on the early fight pass prelims, It's kind of tough, because, I mean, you got 24-7-1 Rashad Evans.
Is it really tough?
28-13 Anthony Smith. I mean, Smith, he's 3-2 in his last five. Rashad Evans, 0-4. Lost two split decisions to Dan Kelly and Sam Alvey. I thought they were pretty, like, I thought it should have been a unanimous decision for those two. But you've got Rashad Evans going up, back up to light heavyweight. You've got Anthony Smith going to light heavyweight. You know, 25 of 28 wins for Smith have been by finish. He's taller. He's got more reach. I don't know. I mean...
You know.
Yeah,
Anthony. Rashad Evans doesn't fight anymore. That's the problem.
It's a shame. It's a shame to see a guy who's had such a great career like him not being able to get it done. I don't know what it is. Like,
it's just
knee injuries.
It's just one of the ways fighters get old. I mean, Rashad Evans is, you know, he's 38 in this game now, and he's been doing this since 2004. And it's like we've seen with Josh Berkman, it's like we're starting to see with Carlos Condit. Yeah. One of the ways fighters get old it, you know, it's not always about injuries. It's not always about, oh, your chin goes, or, oh, you know, you suddenly you don't have the cardio you used to. All those things can happen. Sometimes guys just get to, they can't pull the trigger anymore. They overthink it. They don't have the ability to, their reactions aren't as fast. They're not as willing to be uncautious as they used to be. Age makes people, you know, they start to think a little more like, oh, well, if I throw this punch here, he might counter me. So I'm just going to wait and look for that perfect opening and all that. And we start to see what happened with Rashad Evans, where he doesn't fight. Yeah. Sam Alvey and Dan Kelly just easily outpointed him. Yeah. Like volume striker Sam Alvey just outworked, you know, Rashad Evans. Anthony Smith doesn't have to be anything other than what he is to just win this fight.
Yeah, I mean, the only times I've really seen Smith have issues is when guys kind of push him back against the fence. And Rashad Evans, I think to your point, like, you're totally right there. It's almost like a catcher trying to hit in baseball. You're going up to the plate and you're overthinking what pitch is going to come up, and then you strike out. And it's the same thing. I mean, he's not getting knocked out, but he's totally getting outworked and outpaced. So yeah, it should be decent win for Smith. Prelims, you got the worst nickname in MMA, Daywalker, Rashad Coulter, taking on Chris De La Roca.
That's not even close to worst, but it's, you know, it's not
good.
No, it's not good, but MMA will always provide with terrible nicknames.
He's not a night walker, he's a day walker. Both guys, 0-2 in the UFC. You know, Coulter knocked out by Chase Sherman, Tai Tuivasa, De La Roca, Omar Lanchuk, and Adam Milstead. De La Roca's got wins over DJ Linderman and Matt Kovacs. I mean, that's not bad. DJ Linderman's over the hump, but you get to see him in bare knuckle boxing this past weekend. And he hasn't fought in 2 years.
Yeah, I thought, honestly, I think the thing to know here is that I thought Chris De La Roca was just retired.
Yeah.
So seeing him fight again is, to me, that's just kind of a mystery all by itself. It's like, oh, really? Why?
Yeah. I mean, there's better guys out there that the UFC could have fighting right now. I just had an interview on Tuesday with Canadian heavyweight 14-4 Tanner Boser. Has a win over DJ Linderman. The guy qualifies. I mean, he's top three in ACB right now. And his only big loss is to their current champ. So there's a lot of guys that deserve this spot. But yeah, I think it should be a pretty easy win for Rashad Coulter in that fight.
Uh-huh.
He's been active as well. And then,
I mean, I don't even know about easy. I would just pick
Then
neither guy is good enough to have an easy fight in the UFC.
No. Your next fight, you've got my up-and-comer from this week. I think I'm going to go with the odds on this one. You got number 7, 18-6, Lamas taking on 12-1, Mirsad Bektik. Bektik's only loss is to Darren Elkins by knockout. Came back in January, got the win against Godofredo Pepe, body punch. That was pretty cool. I mean, 6 knockouts, 3 submission wins, 3 decisions, and he's taking on Lamas. Lamas' big losses before he lost to Josh Emmett was Chad Mendes, Jose Aldo, Max Holloway, Yuri Alcantara, and Danny Castillo. So that Emmett loss was definitely a surprise. I mean, I think Lamas was like number 3 at the time, and Emmett was 11. So it's kind of that same thing, 7-11. But I'm picking Bektik to win. I think he's going to get himself into the top 10. And I mean, by the UFC site's metrics, he's better at takedowns, and he's a more efficient striker too.
Well, I mean, the thing with Ricardo Lamas on his way even to being a top-ranked fighter is not that he was necessarily really very good at any one thing. He's, you know, a decent wrestler, a decent grappler, a decent striker. Not really great at any. It was always that he was really tough, and he was a great opportunist. So you could be beaten his ass, and if you make a mistake, he'll land that one punch, he'll jump on that one submission opportunity, he'll hit that one takedown that totally turns the fight around. And, you know, that's how you see, like, well, win over Jason Knight, he just dominated Knight, but Charles Oliveira eventually just turning the tide and, like, finding the submission over him, and Dennis Bermudez jumping on that guillotine after hurting him, and Eric Cope splitting him open with elbows and things like that. Cub Swanson, too. Like, he just has a history of being really opportunistic. And the question then becomes, with the Emmett loss, is he tough enough to be opportunistic still? Because that does look like a fight that Lamas should have just won like he always did, where he rides through some tough spots, but Emmett, like we saw against Jeremy Stephens right afterward, does everything at one speed. You can read him, you can time him and figure him out, and Jeremy Stephens did, and alongside the illegal knee, still managed to, you know, catch him coming in and knock him out. But if Lamas isn't tough enough to be that same fighter that he used to be the guy that eats shots, loses the kickboxing battle for a little while, loses the wrestling battle or the grappling battle for a little while, and then suddenly finds that moment to capitalize, then Mirsad Bektic absolutely has the power and the athleticism and the bull-forward style to beat him. It's just the other thing we've also seen is Mirsad Bektic fucking losing to Darren Elkins. And Darren Elkins is...
Hey, he's the damage.
Yeah, I know. I like Darren Elkins a lot. I've liked Darren Elkins before he went on this run. But it does stand, like, if it's a fight of attrition where... both, you know, where Bektic, even with Bektic winning, and Lamas can take the shots, can stay in the fight, can be, you know, tough into the third round. We've seen Bektic shut down winning a fight, and it's worth watching. I mean, I think the pick to make would be Bektic to start out well and to take early rounds just off relentless aggression, but, well, you know, Lamas is good enough that if Bektic can't maintain, I wouldn't at all be surprised to see Lamas come back and submit him or knock him out.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Next fight on the card is, honestly, I'm not, no bullshit, I think this one's a tough one to call. I think, you know, number 3, 15-3, Claudia Gadelha taking on Carla Esparza. Esparza in her last two fights look good.
She has.
And Gadelha, you know, in her last fight against Jessica Andrade, got taken down, got outstruck 141-42, and she's a striker. And I mean, in my opinion, Jessica Andrade, I think she's going to win the title at some point. But It's tough. Esparza, 3-2 in her last five. She looked good against Cynthia Calvillo. The odds are roughly -525 Gadelha, +425 Esparza. And I don't think that's fair at all. I mean, by fight metrics, if Esparza can take it to the ground, she could win. Gadelha's, you know, she's got wins over Egler, Kovalevich, Courtney Casey. But it's tough. I mean, put a lot of research into this fight, and I'm not sure. I mean, Gadelha, 3-3 in her last six. It's tough.
Yeah, but it's 3-3 against Jessica Andrade and Joanna Jędrzejczyk twice.
Yeah.
I mean, there's an apples to oranges comparison to be made there with Carla Esparza losing to Randa Markos. Like, hey, I like Randa Markos.
Quiet Storm, yeah, Canadian. You can never bet
against him. Yeah, okay. Calm yourself. But Randa Markos is not Jessica Andrade. She's not, you know?
Hey, you got former champ Carla Esparza.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big thing is, honestly, the reason that the odds are as skewed as they are and is really just comes down to athleticism. I think, you know, calling Gadelha just a striker doesn't really cover how good a wrestler and grappler she is. And yeah, maybe Andrade is stronger and more powerful, which is what we saw. Andrade is just a bigger bully and a better wrestler, and she was able to command top position and from there just beat Gadelha up. But we also saw Claudia Gadelha beat Carolina Kowalkiewicz right before that fight, and I would pick Kowalkiewicz to beat Carla Esparza.
Yeah.
So, Molly, come on, Jesus.
Molly's fired up over the fight.
Yeah. So I think the big thing with athleticism, I mean, what we've seen, like what we saw with Carla Esparza in her fight against Cynthia Calvillo was really kind of a commentary on Calvillo's unwillingness to be the wrestler that she can be, where she just kind of acquiesced to a kickboxing bout with Carla Esparza and got out-hustled.
Which is strange. I mean, Cynthia Calvillo, I thought, along with Yair Rodriguez, I thought the point that the UFC was making, especially with the body armor deal, and it kind of seemed hand-in-hand, those two were going to be, you know, big stars. And then we've seen Cynthia Calvillo, you lose to Carla Esparza, you get popped for marijuana, and you lose your body armor deal. So,
yeah,
it's kind of, that's a strange one. But as far
as they cut Yair Rodriguez, he's back now, but, you know.
Yeah, they cut him. And, yeah, it's, I'm assuming you'd go Gedalia, and I'm going to say Carla Esparza.
Yeah, I would be pretty, it would be a pretty big upset. I think that, I mean, I think Esparza's earned this shot again. I think with her wins, she's been, you know, she's shown that she's making the adjustments and working hard, especially to be a better boxer, to climb the ranks again. But that top few of, like, the Claudia Gedalia, Carolina Kowalkiewicz, Jessica Andrade, Joanna Jędrzejczyk, and Rose Namajunas, that top five, those are tough women to get past.
Yeah.
They are all in their own ways. Kowalkiewicz is the worst athlete among them, and she's just, you know, a constant pace-pushing, volume-striking machine. So, Gedalia, I mean, for Esparza to be able to win this fight on the ground, she would really have to be able to, I think she'd have to out-muscle Gedalia, or catch her sleeping technically and just be able to turn enough corners wrestling that Gedalia can't keep up. But we haven't really seen Esparza out, like, that physicality on the mat. That's something she struggled with consistently. Like I said, it's something she struggled with against Marcos. Something she, you know, it's something she struggled with against Calvillo, even. Like, Calvillo, on the mat, that was a much more even contest than it when it was a kickboxing match, and Esparza was just throwing more and landing more. So, I don't know. It would be surprising to me to see Esparza win it, but I like the optimism.
Very best. Last fight on the prelims. Former Ubreme, now just Overeem. Overeem taking on Blaydes. It's a tough one. Overeem's obviously a better striker. Overeem's takedown defense at 76%. I mean, when he took on Ngannou, that was his problem. He went in for that takedown against the fence and couldn't get him down and then get knocked out. So, I mean, Blaydes is a wrestler. Overeem 3-2 in his last five. I mean, the only losses to Stipe and to Ngannou, and then he beat Verdum. Hunt's kind of one that you got to discount a little bit just based on his chin and kind of where he's nearing the end of his
career. I mean, Hunt at this point just has a regular heavyweight chin.
Yeah.
It's not a bad chin for heavyweight. Getting knocked out by Overeem is, you know, he still took everything Curtis Blaydes could throw at him and didn't get knocked out by Brock Lesnar, or, you know, it's been knockouts like Junior Dos Santos, Stipe Miocic, Alistair Overeem, and that flying knee from Werdum. He now has an average heavyweight chin.
That's fair. And then Blaydes, coming off that win over Hunt, only losses to Ngannou, 7 knockout wins and 9 wins. I mean, if it goes to the ground, which is something that I'm trying to think of the fight. I mean, Werdum and Volkov, I thought as soon as that goes to the ground, it's Verdum's fight to win. And there was a fight here recently where I said, as soon as that fight goes to the ground, so-and-so is going to win, and it didn't happen at all. And I was totally wrong. But, I mean, if it goes to the ground, I would think Overeem would go for a submission. But then if you watch some of Overeem's fights, he just kind of sits in guard, and he's kind of all right with it. And somebody will land some ground and pound, and he gets beat.
I mean, it's worth remembering that Alistair Overeem's last submission win was James Thompson at Dream 12. In 2009.
Yeah, you're right.
So, I wouldn't bet on Overeem by submission.
No, that's fair. I mean, he's got submission wins, obviously more knockouts than submissions. I've got Overeem to win the fight.
He used to be he started out as a grappler who then became a kickboxer.
And a light heavyweight, too.
Yeah, he started out as like a...
Yeah.
Was it even light heavyweight? I mean, it was kind of just like open weight, but it probably would have been a middleweight at the time started.
My classic Overeem fight to watch is when he fought Shogun at Pride. I think that was 2005, and Shogun beat him. And even fights back 2005, 2006, he was definitely thin.
Yeah.
And then he obviously got larger, and now he's still a heavyweight. But, I think if the fight stays standing, height and reach, you would think Overeem has an advantage, but they're both the same. So I can't really see Blades. I mean, he might, if he wins, he takes him down, and they get back up, and then he takes him down, and it's just going to be, more takedowns than anything, and he pushes the pace. But to me, I think Overeem would win. It's not like a matchup where Overeem took on a Travis Brown, and Brown utilized distance management and finally sunk one of those kicks through his guard, I guess.
Yeah, I'm very much in toss-up territory on this one. The other big thing to think about is cardio. Overeem, he's got a bit of a pot belly these days sometimes. He doesn't look like a fighter in the best shape anymore. And his last two wins the last three wins he's had, Arlovsky, Hunt, and Verdum, are all over fighters that are past their prime and especially Hunt and Verdum, not known for their cardio either and their ability to outpace anyone late in fights anymore. If Blades can push a pace on him and just, get him down, make this fight a mess, just make this fight ugly for a while, I wouldn't necessarily bet against Overeem gassing out. Overeem also has a tendency to panic and then get himself hit really hard and hurt really badly. It's something that's plagued him his whole career, being not just having a bad chin, which he's always had, but he's always had kind of a bully mentality where he likes to, if he's not controlling the fight, things start going wrong a little bit and they just slide immediately out of control. And he's changed that up to be like more of a dynamic pot-shotting fighter from the outside rather than a guy who just walked in and stalked after people with huge shots and tried to make them quit and cringe and shy away from him. But if he's getting bullied, I mean, I think that's part of what happened in that Ngannou fight, honestly. It's not so much he couldn't take him down, it's that he clinched up with Ngannou and then was like, holy shit, this dude's way stronger than me.
Yeah.
Suddenly, he gets back out at range, he's just like, I gotta just like panic and start swinging at him and go after him, and walked right into a counter shot. So, there's a chance. Technically, this should be Overeem's fight to win, but there's a chance that Blades just takes it by being tough as shit and going after him for every round.
That makes sense. I mean, the only time I thought Blades was going to have a hard time out of any of those wins, and I don't agree with it, and everybody thinks I'm crazy, but the fight against Alexei Olenek, I thought he's going to try and take it to the ground, and it's either going to be an Ezekiel, and you can laugh about Ezekiels all you want, but man, he's got a lot of Ezekiel wins if you go through.
Yeah, I mean, Alexei Olenek is a testament to the fact that fighters don't watch tape on their opponents.
No, that's totally true. And I thought it was going to be an issue. And then Blades kicked him while he had points down. And to me, the ear is a part of your head, so it's illegal. But a lot of people don't think it is. And it was a TKO due to doctor stoppage. I thought Olenek was smart in that fight, milking it off for all it was worth. I mean, he was hurt, but at the same time, I thought it was his fight. But yeah, I mean, Curtis Blades, if he pushes the pace, he'll get the win. On your main card, yo, go ahead.
Oh, no. I was going to say that, like, Travis Brown isn't necessarily any better a striker than Curtis Blades, and he still beat Overeem just by being
but
tough.
But then again, Olenek punched Travis Brown, got him to the ground, beat him.
Well, yeah, that's what I'm saying, is that if a fighter as beatable as Travis Brown can beat Alistair Overeem, everybody's got a chance just by sticking around.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing for Brown is he did beat an orc in that promo for the UFC, so keep that in mind. Main card, a fight I'm sure you are tired of talking about, and
I haven't really actually had to talk about it much already yet.
I've seen in the last 2 days more stuff about it than I have. I thought it was going to be big talk, but Chick Magnet Punk taking on Mike Jackson. It's tough for me. I retweeted a tweet today, and I don't know if I commented on it or not, but it was where CM Punk said that he didn't want to go to the open workouts due to anxiety, which I don't get anxiety very often. It's not something that bothers me, but to me, I understand what he's saying. To me, I used to, you know, public speaking was my thing. You go up in front of a big group of people. It's totally different than when you're in front of, you know, 100 strangers that you don't recognize or 20 strangers that you don't know. So I understand what he meant. And, you know, MMA, he get into it later on in life. And, you know, if he slips up or, you know, he misses a mitt when he's going for a punch or something, and you've got members of either the media or the public and they laugh at him, I mean, that's just, you don't want that. So I get where he's coming from. But at the same time, man, you're on the main card of a pay-per-view. Go to the open workouts. Like, what's the worst thing that could happen? Just wrestle around with your coach a little bit or go there and spend time with the fans. But
I mean, I think he did. Didn't he actually, like, he just didn't work out, I thought. Wasn't that it? Or did he just skip it altogether?
He didn't work out and he took some interviews. That's what I saw.
Yeah, yeah. He showed up and talked to people, but he didn't work out.
No. And so there hasn't been a lot of talk about Mike Jackson. I think the only reason why he's in the UFC right now is because he's friends with Mick Maynard. He was a photographer and a videographer, from what I saw, at Legacy. So that's kind of why he's there. He's got a boxing and a kickboxing background. From the fights that I've seen, I don't know if he won any, but he has a background in it. And Punk's still with Duke Rufus. So, I mean, Mike Jackson, 33. Punk's 39. I don't know what... Like, why is Punk doing this? What's the point?
It's a vanity project.
If he gets a win, I guess. Yeah, I mean, they could make a documentary about it. But
it's just a vanity project. He wants to prove he can, and he's rich enough to get to.
Yeah. Do you think we have a shot, maybe?
Of what? Of fighting in the UFC or beating CM Punk?
Or like a pay-per-view. Maybe like UFC.
Oh, no. I mean... He's famous. It's the rights of being a millionaire who's already a celebrity.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, Mike Jackson.
You picking him?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly don't think there's any reason to pick either of them. I think there's a reasonable chance that CM Punk may be more athletic than Mike Jackson, as sad as that is.
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah, you know, people are like, oh, well, Mike Jackson's done kickboxing and boxing. Like, yeah, he still got shit kicked in 45 seconds by Mickey Gall.
Yeah.
Like, it's not like he showed up and did better than CM Punk.
Like, Punk, you can make fun of wrestlers all you want, professional wrestlers. But they go out there, what, twice, maybe three times a week? They do shows. They're always keeping their body in shape. They're always traveling. So their cardio's got to be good. Plus... In all the documentaries that they showed leading up to his fight with Mickey Gall, Punk's fight with Mickey Gall, he was wrestling in the gym. I didn't see a whole lot of striking. I saw a whole lot of wrestling. So it's possible it goes to the decision, and maybe he just tries to take him down. But at the same time...
I wouldn't
time,
be at all surprised if this goes to a decision. Yeah. Or if Punk gets, like, some sloppy-ass rear-naked choke where we're just like, oh, God.
Yeah. At the same time, I've seen the clip the last couple of days where Punk went to throw a right, and Mickey Gall wasn't there and took him down, and it looked silly. Yeah. So Mike Jackson could capitalize on that. But
Mike Jackson's not half as good as Mickey Gall.
No, and he's got a loss to him. But
like I said, I mean, I actually think there's a chance CM Punk might be a better athlete than Mike Jackson, frankly, but I don't. The only reason to pick Mike Jackson here, honestly, is the fact that CM Punk, like the whole open workout thing, I mean, if you're that worried about performing in front of 50 people that might laugh at you, you're about to get up in front of 10,000 people. And there's, you know, while he's been a good big stage performer in pro wrestling, that's totally different. That's something that he was good at, something that was scripted, where you know the outcome, you know how it's going to look, you know that your opponent is going to help you through it all the way. basically just a team performance.
Hey, the injuries are real.
The injuries are real. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying it doesn't take physical fitness of some sort. I mean, we still, you know, there's still a lot of bodybuilders who are getting themselves through it on pain pills, but I'm not saying it doesn't take physical fitness or that it doesn't require physicality, but I'm saying that being confident as a pro wrestler doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to be a confident fighter. And at this point, we have no reason to think that he's a confident fighter. We haven't seen anything in his in-cage performances that shows like, oh yeah, this guy really knows what he's doing out there. But we haven't seen that from Jackson either. So the slight tell of Punk being a little more, being worried about what he's going to look like in open workouts is maybe enough to push me to be like, yeah, pick Mike Jackson. But
it's honestly a weird one too, because I mean, he was at Wrigley the other day, and he sang "Take Me Out the Ball Game" with Guida. And there's fans there too. So,
like I said, being able to do things that are like fine and have no real downside is a whole different skill than being able to go out and compete and potentially get terribly embarrassed athletically.
That's fair.
I don't really have, like, if he's feeling that anxiety like he says he is, then pick Jackson. Otherwise, there's nothing to differentiate these two guys, honestly.
No, that totally makes sense. And
it'd be like picking an opening prelim on an LFA card, you know?
I don't do that, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's fair. Number 9, Arlovski, taking on number 12, Tuivasa. For me, if it goes to decision, Arlovski wins. But Tuivasa's got such power. Again, he fought Cyril Asker and Rashad Coulter.
Yeah, it doesn't. His wins don't yet mean anything.
No. But other than knockout wins in 9 fights, and Arlovski lost 5 in a row, but they were all the good fighters, and they kind of found his groove fighting Albini and Struve, which, again, it's kind of tough. But, yeah, goes to the decision, Arlovski. Mm-hmm. If not, Tuivasa gets the knockout. It's minus 250, roughly, for Tuivasa, plus 200 for Arlovski. So, I mean, if you're really banking on a decision, I'd go with Arlovski. I mean, I know on Fight Night Picks, but it's a tough one.
Yeah, no, it's a little, it's too much too soon for Tai Tuivasa, honestly. If he wins by quick knockout, like he very easily could, it won't prove anything. Arlovsky's chin has never been good. Knocking out Arlovski early in the first round won't make Tai Tuivasa suddenly a world-beating fighter. And if he loses to Arlovski, it just shows what we already know, which is that Tai Tuivasa is incredibly raw. And he makes a lot of the kind of decisions in fights that make it very easy for him to lose to Andre Arlovski.
Yeah.
He really loves to try to do sacrifice throws in the cage. And to date, almost every single sacrifice throw he's attempted has just ended up with him dragging his opponent down on top of him. And he doesn't pay for it because he's a good athlete, he's tough, and he's aggressive, so he just, you know, jumps right back up and starts throwing shots again. But he still only fought one round at that, so if he goes past a round, does he have cardio to go more? He looked exhausted against James McSweeney in 2016. To his credit, I do think that these last two fights against Coulter and Asker, he has showed improvement. He did look, at the end of the round against Coulter, he looked fresh when he threw that flying knee that knocked him out. He didn't look like somebody who'd exhausted himself. But how, you know, does that carry him halfway into the second round? Does that carry him 2 whole rounds? We don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what his cardio is going to look like. The one thing that kind of, it doesn't worry me, but on one of the embedded episodes, he was out for supper with his brother's family, and then he said, oh, you know, I can't have that, and oh, I can't eat this. So I doubt he has to cut a lot of weight, and it probably, like, I shouldn't put a lot of stock into that, but at the same time, if you're a heavyweight cutting weight, you never know. I mean, Sean Jordan missed weight for tonight's fight.
So, yeah, he's the first guy to miss weight in, like, a fucking decade.
It's really strange, PFL's rules, that heavyweights have to be within 30 pounds of each other, because I know there was a fight in Bellator recently where one guy weighed in at like 265 and the other guy weighed in at 214. It was Robert Moro, and he got the win, the way smaller guy. So a strange rule, but anyway, as for Tuivasa, I mean, hopefully if he does have to make a weight cut, doesn't have to sacrifice too much in cardio. We haven't seen him, you know, to a decision yet. And Arlovsky's, yeah, he's looked really good in his last two fights. I mean, he outclassed Struve, beat Albini quite well. I mean, he almost looks like a new fighter. He throws his shots. I mean, he's not knocking guys out anymore, but he's definitely a smart fighter.
And he still has the speed he's always had in his hands. He doesn't necessarily have the foot speed he used to have. He used to be really light on his feet. He's not that guy anymore. But he's got the speed in his hands still. He's become a more dedicated, better boxer lately.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's being a crafty old heavyweight, which gets you places. I'm still picking Tuivasa just because I think he's so relentlessly aggressive with his power in a way that neither Struve nor Albini can be, that I think he just kind of is going to clip Arlovsky with some random clubbing shot and win it. But
yeah,
like I said, that won't prove anything.
I'll go with Tuivasa too. And to your point, to me, it's not like he gets the win. All right, prove it to me. Like, go out there and fight another guy that's going to propel you into that. Like, I know, I mean, he'll probably be in the top 10, but get into the top 5. I mean, the UFC's putting a lot of stock into these guys that are winning fights. I mean, Volkov was a champ in Bellator. He was a champ in M1. Curtis Blaydes has fought well recently. They really want to push these younger guys, and it's almost a little bit too early, but at the same time, the talent's not really there. So if he gets a win over Arlovsky, I want to see him fight somebody at that caliber.
I don't know. I mean, I'd be happy to just see him fight somebody like Walt Harris after this, honestly. Like, just put him in there with guys. Like,
that fight makes sense. That's a fun fight. That's like a Just Bleed type fight.
Get Tuivasa some fucking rounds. The kid's had 7 pro fights. This is his 8th pro fight of his career, starting, only really in earnest in 2015. He had 2 fights in 2012, but then nothing for 3 years after that. So, I would just, like, I really would like to see the UFC do the smart thing and just keep Tuivasa busy, get him other guys that are winning down still near the bottom of the heavyweight division, the lower half. Most likely, though, I mean, it wouldn't be hard to imagine them putting him in there with somebody like Josh Barnett, who's back now. And
that's a weird one. Like, do you see him fight Barnett, or what's the scoop with like Ben Rothwell right now?
Ben Rothwell still USADA suspension, I think. I would love, because I mean, that's the kind of thing where like part of me would love that, but that's also like exactly the fight that Tuivasa probably almost certainly loses right now. And then you're like, do we just try to rebuild Ben Rothwell off Tai Tuivasa? Why?
yeah, that's tough. You got another Aussie in the next fight, too. Megan Anderson, Holly Holm. On the website, they're both unranked. Just where they're in that featherweight division, everything's kind of up in the air. Exactly, except for the champ. Holm's the favorite, but she's 1-4 in her last 5. I think she beat Jermaine Durandamy on points. And I think that those 2 shots after, that was ridiculous, but it was kind of New York's feeling out process. And it's Megan Anderson's debut in the UFC. She hasn't fought in a little over a year. Anderson's got 4 inches of reach and 4 inches of height. And, I mean, it's a tough pick right now. Anderson, I think she's plus 195 underdog. So I'm going to go with Anderson. I think, you know, she's got tools in her tool belt. She was able to do it in Invicta. And I'm personally a big Holm fan, but at the same time, I don't think she's going to be able to get the win.
Yeah, I mean, you're putting that much stock in beating Charmaine Tweet?
Yeah, Canadian.
Oh, God, that's right. You fucking homers. But, I mean... I just, Anderson, I think this is kind of going to be her rude wake-up call to higher-level women's MMA. Holly Holm...
I disagree, simply because the idea was supposed to be, it was going to be Megan Anderson fighting for the title against Cyborg.
Yeah.
So I think that this is the fight, yeah, like Holly Holm, obviously she's, you know, she's definitely top five, whether it's featherweight or bantamweight or whatever weight she's going to compete at. Even, you know, I wouldn't say she's over the hump, even though she's 1-4 in her last five. She's still got a lot left in the tank. She's not, she didn't get knocked out by Cyborg, and she put her...
She's incredibly tough.
Exactly. But
really, like, she's in great shape, she's incredibly tough, and she's incredibly difficult to control.
Yeah. But...
So...
Yeah, they wanted Anderson to fight Cyborg. I think that's probably still the plan, so...
What does Anderson do to Holm to beat her?
She's tall.
Okay. I mean, like, you know, Holm is going to always struggle against the very best in the world, as we've seen her, because she doesn't land a lot. She doesn't have any command of range. She's really predictable with her setups.
Yeah.
And so, elite strikers, Valentina Shevchenko, Jermaine Durandamy, Chris Cyborg, women who have all worked really hard to be good, consistent boxers. And as you say, the Durandamy fight, that's a debatable fight. But women who really kickbox at a high technical level can take advantage of the fact that she's always showing them the exact same things over and over and over.
It's the exact same. Three or four strikes. The same, and it's repetition. I mean, against Betch Kohei, it was the same thing, and then Betch wanted more, and she gave it to her.
Yeah.
So, and she's been more active, too.
But, yeah, is Anderson, does she have any of the technical ability to actually make Holm take advantage of the fact that Holm is so predictable? Because most women don't. Most women in either of these divisions just do not have the ability, and they then have to depend on controlling her in the clinch, which, as we saw against Cyborg, Holm's fucking strong. She's really hard to control inside. She was able to just tie Cyborg up and hold her on the cage over and over again, and she's also just very good at clinch breaking, which we've seen from a lot of Jackson Wink fighters. And then she's hard to take down. She's hard to put on her butt and to out wrestle and out grapple because of that. And so if you have to be in a kickboxing bout with her, you kind of have to be a better kickboxer. And I just don't see that yet for Megan Anderson.
All right, you got Holm, I get Anderson. Comey, I think it's pretty cut and dry, interim welterweight title. I think, you know, as far as like a rude awakening, I think this is it. I mean, when you beat Dunhyun Kim, and I like Dunhyun Kim, but it doesn't really mean much to me. When you beat Damian Maia near the end of his career, when he knows how many fights he has left, and he's just kind of counting, crossing days off on the calendar, like, it doesn't mean much to me. You're taking on a guy that's still hungry in RDA, former lightweight champ. I mean, he beat Neil Magny. Neil Magny, to me, is one of the tougher fighters to beat, where he's so long, his cardio is so good, and he doesn't understand range that well, but he understands it enough that he's able to get some wins. And I mean, Craig White wasn't really a great win, and the guy was 14-7, making his UFC debut.
It was not a good win at all. It was not a mean... It was the win he had to get.
Exactly. But, yeah, I think it's a cut-and-dry win for RDA. Better striker. He's got the submission skills if he's taken down. I think the only way Colby wins is kind of the same way that, maybe CM Punk wins, is if he's able to take him down and take him down and take him down. That might be the only
way. Well, yeah, that's the only, tends to be the only way that Colby Covington wins any fights, other than...
He outstruck Damian Maia.
No, he didn't. He outpaced Damian Maia. Yeah. Damian Maia outstruck him early in that fight, and then Colby Covington just stayed relentless. But... I don't really necessarily see the sense in saying that beating Neil Magny is a better win than beating Damian Maia. Damian Maia's a much, you know, he absolutely schooled Neil Magny without any trouble. Neil Magny's, I get that he's like,
he's still hungry though. And Maia's coming off, you know, loss for the title and then loss and loss.
That's just, like, sports talk, though. He's still hungry. He still wants it. He's a blue-collar, gritty, hard-nosed guy who just goes after it. And, yeah, he doesn't really hurt anybody and can't grapple very well. I mean, he grapples better than Carlos Condit because he wrestles better than Carlos Condit because everybody wrestles better than Carlos Condit. But, you know, Magny is like, he's that litmus test of, are you an elite fighter or not? Can you beat Neil Magny?
Yeah.
RDA, I'm picking RDA too, though. But I think there is a real, like, if Covington can just get a body lock and keep it,
yeah.
It doesn't even have to be necessarily taking RDA down. It's just all about getting a body lock and keeping it and getting into that, like, top ride drag where you're just leaning on the cage against somebody with the body lock on, tripping the legs, sweep, you know, dipping for an ankle every now and then, pulling them one way, pushing the other. All that stuff that Covington can do really well. And we did see, like, RDA did get a kick caught and got put on his butt against Tarek Saffiedine and ended up there for most of the round after that, which is a little troubling if Colby Covington can get something like that going. Otherwise, though, I think the big things are that Covington kind of seems like he wants to strike right now. But we saw the Dong Young Kim fight, he was very dedicated to wrestling. But a lot of that, too, was that Dong Young Kim was dedicated to wrestling him. Yeah. Kim would just run in and close the distance and try to throw strikes and try to, like, make it a inside clinch wrestling match against Colby Covington, which is a terrible idea. And then against Damian Maya, Covington came out and he just spent most of that fight trying to kickbox. And yeah. He did a lot of the same thing against Brian Barberena. He mixed it up more in that. But so if Covington comes out wanting just to strike, Rafael Dos Anjos should eat him up. If he comes out looking to wrestle a lot, I would still pick Dos Anjos. He's still RDA. He's too hard to take down, too hard to control. His cardio is too good, so getting him tired, like what we saw against Covington against Dong Young Kim. Late in that fight, Covington went from a lot of bad shots from outside, got sprawled out, and then Kim just didn't separate and stayed there and let Covington chain through and sit him down and really take over from positions where Stun Gun should have been able to do more. And I think that RDA can be he's an aggressive, hard enough working, enough of a bully of a fighter to take over in those positions instead. So I would still pick him overall, and it's just, I mean, the skill disparity standing up is huge.
Yeah, exactly. But, so there's not going to be any nerd bashing? Is that what you're saying?
Probably not. No, I mean, no. No. Yeah.
Right. Main event. I think it's tough to call. It's another one. There's a lot of, like, this is one of the best cards, obviously, and the matchmaking's pretty much flawless, really, except for the chick magnet fight. And Yoel, he had that good win over Luke Rockhold. I think Luke Rockhold's stocks dropped quite a bit since he lost to Bisping. I mean, the win over Branch, he ate so many punches when Branch went forward into the cage. And yep. Then, you know, Romero, obviously, one of the toughest fighters to fight, regardless of weight class. I mean, such a good wrestler. He's been a great striker as well. A lot of knockout wins. And he beat, like, a guy who was closer to his prime at one point, Lyoto Machida, and Tim Kennedy, too. So,
yep.
Yoel Romero's got that going for him. At the same time, Whitaker's won 8 in a row. Since he's come to middleweight, he looks great. And he had good takedown defense in his last fight with a bad knee. So,
yeah,
it's tough. I mean, in that first fight, there were 4 takedowns were 4-0 for Yoel, but the striking was 74-48 for Whitaker. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've really kind of tossed and turned. It's been a tough one for me to try and figure out. If Yoel can get in there early, close the distance, and push him up against the cage like he did against Rockhold, maybe. But, yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, Whitaker could totally outstrike him and stuff those takedowns.
Whitaker, kind of like Joanna, he has some of the best technical takedown defense in the game, just in terms of he gets his hips in the right place, he gets his hands in the right place, he moves in the right direction, and then he gets up quickly and knows how to get off his back in a hurry. to keep takedowns from counting for a lot. He's a really difficult fighter to control in that way. And it's worth noting, too, that Romero isn't really a grappler in any way. I don't think he's ever submitted anyone, ever.
No, I think all his wins are either by knockout or decision.
So when he takes people down, like, his options with somebody who's as good at getting up with Whitaker are he either tries to hurt him quickly and lets him back up quickly, or he has to just kind of hold him down and try and blanket him. And neither of those are great options against Whitaker. The danger for Whitaker is that the way he showed he needs to win this fight against Yoel Romero, the thing that is the smartest path for him is to stay on Romero, keep in his face, keep pressure on him, keep volume on him, make him fight at a pace that he's uncomfortable with. Because Romero, you know, given his ideal fight, Romero is a pretty slow-paced fighter. He likes to just kind of stay way outside, look for his opportunities to pot shot, and then he'll throw big strikes with power, and he can do those at any moment. And by keeping a lot of pressure on Whitaker, or by Whitaker keeping a lot of pressure on Romero, especially in those early rounds, he lost those rounds. He ate, you know, he walked into a lot of hard strikes. He walked into a lot of takedowns. But he also wore out Romero. He also forced Romero to fight hard, to push a pace that he didn't want to. And I think Whitaker can still afford to do that. You know, he's crafty enough. He's tough as hell. He's really hard to hurt.
Like, is this fight going to be another one that goes to decision?
It easily could.
Yeah.
Yoel Romero is very hard to hurt himself. He's only been knocked out once early in his career by Rafael Cavalcante when he had a lot more... when he had the kind of confidence that has carried him through with his striking for the rest of his career, but was unwarranted against Cavalcante, where he was just kind of like hands down, drifting around, looking in front of him, ate a huge shot and got knocked out. That's made Romero a much better striker down the road, but at the time... He's never been knocked out since, and he's faced plenty of people who can hit hard, plenty of people who are willing to go after him. So there's every chance that Romero doesn't get knocked out and this goes to a decision, but I think the story is all going to be about Whitaker's toughness and his ability to press a pace on Romero that gives Romero opportunities, but Romero can't match as the fight goes on. And as long as Whitaker can still be dedicated to doing that, that should be an advantage, a natural advantage that he'll have no matter what. Like, that dynamic in this fight shouldn't change because Whitaker's still the much younger guy who's, you know, other than that knockout from Stephen Thompson, has never otherwise been stopped by strikes.
Yeah, I think the time off could play a factor. You know, he was already training for the fight at 221,
yep.
But at the same time, he definitely had a bad knee injury for him to be out from the summer of last year all the way to this spring. And then he ran into the stomach issues. So I don't know personally, I have no idea what's going on in his camp.
It's true. If he doesn't have the physicality to push Romero, then
And you know, Yoel Romero, I mean, I don't know if it was this embedded or if it was the last one, but at one point he had a knee injury himself, and they were kind of working on it. It was a little tender, but Yoel Romero's definitely, he's got good cardio for the most part. He's, for a big guy that most likely has to cut a lot of weight, he's able to get it back and have good cardio. Physique-wise, obviously one of the best ones out there, and a hell of a dancer, too. And... so it's kind of a tough one. I mean, if both guys are at 100%, I could see this fight going to decision and going exactly like their last fight went and going like Thompson Woodley went. Same type of idea. Striker and a guy that's a bit of a wrestler, or a wrestler, and it could go exactly that way and both tentative. But to your point, I think Whitaker with distance management, with the kickboxing that he has, if he can land shots from distance, it's his fight to lose. Obviously. I mean, he's a champ.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, Whitaker's never been nearly as the tentative fighter that what we've seen out of Wonder Boy as his career's gone on. Because Whitaker, I mean, he can counterpunch. He counterpunches well. But like we saw in the Yoel Romero fight, he's happy to lead. He is happy to be the first one out, you know, off the punch, the first one throwing strikes. He looks to set up his game behind offense, whereas Thompson looks to set up his game behind defense. And that, I think, is exactly the kind of thing that will allow him to win this fight, is that he can push offense. He can push a pace on Yoel Romero. Whereas if, you know, he just tried to stay on the back foot, tried to pick his shots, tried to be really crafty and all that, then you're just getting into like a 50-50 power punch exchange with Yoel Romero, where Romero, you know, where you might be able to land the first shot, or he might be able to land the first shot. And it doesn't take advantage of the fact that you can probably afford to make him more tired than he can afford to make you.
Yeah, so we both have Whitaker in this fight, and it should be a great event. One of the best ones so far this year. I think 226, you never know, could be better than this, but yeah, one of the best ones this year, unless we get the tournament that they're talking about.
We're not going to get that.
We're not going to get that. And we didn't get Connor at 224 either.
Yeah, that's such a
that one doesn't make any sense.
It's a pipe dream pseudo story thing that I am almost absolutely sure the UFC just dreamed up, and Connor dreamed up afterward, as a way to show that he'd been punished in some way. Like, they were just gonna drop him into that UFC 224 card on like a few weeks' notice just to get him out there. That's, you know, this is a person that the UFC organized like their entire promotional style and contract agreements and all that around for like 6 months to get that Mayweather fight made. There's no way that they're just like, oh yeah, no, here's Conor McGregor. He's going to fight RDA at welterweight in Rio. Whatever. Sure. Nah.
All right, Zane. Where can people find you?
Oh, they can find me on Twitter at TheZaneSimon. They can find me over at Bloody Elbow, writing day in, day out. And they can find me over at MMANation.com, DOTCOM, on YouTube, where I do weekly shows, the Vivisection, Sixth Round, MMA Depressed Us. We'll be back with the Depressed Us this week. I've got to do the Vivi tomorrow, and then we'll be back after the fights on 225 Saturday night for the sixth round.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
All right, it was awesome to have Zane on the podcast. We get a chance to go over all of UFC 225. Also, note that this weekend you've got the Charlo Trout fight going on. Pick Charlo to win in that one. Trout's got a few more miles on him. No doubt one of the best that there is out there. He's got losses to Canelo, Arislandi Lara, Jermall Charlo, and Jared Hurd. And he won his last fight in February this year, but he's taking on Jermall. I mean, Jermall's a stud. Obviously brother with Jermall, and 30-0 right now with 15 knockouts and 15 decisions. So take Charlo to win in that fight. You've also got Tyson Fury making his return to the ring. I was going to say cage, and he hasn't fought since 2016. So trying to get back up, climb the ladder in the heavyweight division, taking on 39-year-old Safari. And there were some videos, I kind of talked about it early, but there were some videos of Safari on Twitter where he was just kind of doing distance management, trying to hit the pads, and they tried to make him look bad. I mean, the guy's been active. He's already got a fight this spring, so it should be a good fight, but take Tyson Fury to win in his return. And you've also got Jeff Horn and Terrence Crawford squaring off on Saturday. I mean, if you really look into it, Jeff Horn's got a win over Manny Pacquiao somewhat recently, July of 2017. He's 18-0-1. Crawford is 32-0. He's got 23 knockouts and 9 wins by decision. I'm going to take Crawford in that fight. I know there's kind of a lot of people that are on the fence, but take Crawford in that fight. And that just about does it for this episode of the Fight Night Picks podcast. So I'd like to thank our guests. We had Gerald Harris and Zane Simon. Thank our sponsors, Sisu Mouthguards and First Row Collectibles. I'll be back again on Monday to break down and analyze the cards from this past weekend, spend some more time on the boxing fights. And we've got a guest lined up for Monday as well. So hopefully you'll join me there, episode 18. And we'll see you again on Monday.